Welcome to The Lead from New Lines Magazine. I'm Lisa Goldman, and this is a podcast where we delve into the biggest ideas, events, and personalities from around the world. The international media's reporting of the war in Gaza, now in its fifth month, has become a controversial topic. Some say the coverage dehumanizes Palestinians and is overly sympathetic to Israel. Advocates for Israel say the international media has failed to convey the country's deep trauma after the events of October 7th. Meanwhile, media analysts have noticed that Israel's domestic television news programs do not show the toll the war is taking on Gaza's civilians. Israeli television's reporting of the war has, indeed, played a crucial role in shaping the Jewish-Israeli national discourse. This is not a new phenomenon. Over the past 30 years or so, in tandem with the privatization of Israel's economy, domestic television news has come to occupy a powerful and perhaps unique role in shaping the national discourse and memory. Our guest on this episode, Laliv Melamed, is an assistant professor of film studies at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. In her 2023 book, Sovereign Intimacy, Private Media and the Traces of Colonial Violence, she looks specifically at how Israeli television coverage of its wars, particularly of the soldiers who are killed, has affected the national discourse. More specifically, we will talk about how those videos have enabled a collective turning away from the impact of the army's violence on Palestinians in the territories under Israeli control. Laliv, welcome to The Lead.
Thank you, Lisa.
Laliv, I want to first ask you about one particular day and its importance to Israeli society. That day is Memorial Day, and it's the day every year that Israel officially mourns the people who have been killed in war or in terror attacks. The whole country comes to a halt. There's a two-minute siren that announces a time when everyone on the streets has to stand absolutely still, and the cars stop, people get out of their cars, they stand in the middle of the road. Your focus in this book, Sovereign Intimacy, is on one particular aspect of Israel's Memorial Day, which is the television programming. You write that these televised home movies about fallen soldiers began as a memorial project. This was in the 1990s, shortly after the launch of commercial television in Israel, which is important. Before that, there was just one state broadcaster, which was boring. And suddenly we had commercial private networks that played this very important role. So what were the circumstances behind the making and broadcasting of the first memorial film? Tell me about how that first film quickly evolved into these back-to-back films that are broadcast for hours on Memorial Day.
The book focuses on a very particular programming slot within this bracketed day of mourning, which is a marginal programming slot, in which homemade commemorative videos made by individual families without mostly the intervention of television or any other commercial or professional film entity. These isolated videos produced by families are being broadcast back to back. So when I started working on these videos very, very early on, my initial reading of them, that they were actually a way to resist national ideology of occupation, that in Israel sometimes dubbed as defense, Israel also a way to resist Israeli militarism. One of the things that strikes me is that the video also surfaces in times that actually there is a deep ideological and political crisis in Israel, and actually in times where when Israel was occupying southern Lebanon, and there was a lot of resistance to this occupation, that actually, in this resistance, the family comes as the strongest anti-occupation voice. So one of the questions that I ask myself, is the family outside politics or not? One of my hypotheses is that, at this point, the family somehow questions or challenge Israeli militaristic ideology, and the the compliance of Israeli civil society with the army. And in a way, the videos calling upon personal loss, we can think about them as a way to point the attention to the price of war, to the price of the ongoing aggression. So that was my initial understanding of the videos. When I started working on them, it struck me that, first of all, the family become a safe space of consensus in light of this ideological and political crisis. So we stick to the personal memory. We distance ourselves, or we Jewish Israelis as a whole, we distance ourselves from the national sentiment of military death that, you know, excuse violence as a form of heroism and defense. We stick to the private, we stick to the personal as a way, in a way, to safeguard the consensus that Israel have around the army and around its ongoing mission of aggression dubbed as defense. So for me, it was really interesting to think how the family sits both, like sits in this equation, both as the kind of like, you know, voice of resistance to politics, but also, you know, a space that disavows politics altogether, that completely depoliticize military death, although military death is the most political manifestation, or, you know, the most violent manifestation of politics. The other thing, of course, is that, you know, by sticking to privatized death, what we get is a very, very partial image of violence. So, you know, the subjects of that violence, Palestinians and Lebanese, are completely absent because the dead are private individuals. They're not soldiers who are, you know, a messengers of violence on behalf of the Israeli state. I should stress it that for me, the other thing that was interesting is that in the context of these videos, it shows us how, you know, as privatized and intimate the grief and mourning that was expressed in these videos it was at the same time so strikingly public, which made me ask questions.
I mean, I'm certain, and I know you are too, that the 1982 invasion of Lebanon is the first war that that Israelis really questioned in a critical mass. They questioned whether it was a necessary war. This especially became apparent after the Sabra and Shatila massacre. And so this triggered like a massive public debate, right, about whether or not the war was justified. And for the first time, you know, you saw Israelis who were refusing to serve. There were conscientious objectors, which was unheard of before 1982. There were civil society protest movements, most particularly of women. There were the Women in Black and the Four Mothers, and the Women in Black were just ordinary middle-class Israeli women who wore black t-shirt, black pants, and just stood with black and white signs silently at intersections all over Israel with signs that proclaimed the necessity for ending that war. Can you talk more about, you know, how the 1982 invasion of Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon and the subsequent 18-year occupation worked to undermine this, you know, previously very widely held, maybe universally held perception that the Israeli army was a moral army?
So I think the phenomena that I try to study in the book is very much related to the Lebanon occupation. Although I do think that my argument about the complicity of Israeli civil society with Israel military project, with Israel colonial project, is wider and obviously relevant to what's happening in Palestine at the moment. But I do want to highlight a few things that are specific to the Lebanon occupation that starts this process of, you know, privatization of mourning, personalization of the soldier as a family member, as a son. And here, of course, the gender bias is very much, deliberate. First and foremost, in the Lebanon period, we move from, the idea that war is a framed singular event that has a beginning and an end to a derailed war, to a perpetual war, which is the state we're at also at the current moment and not just in Israel. The second thing, the war takes place I mean, the battlefield is abroad, is distance. It's not, you know, a fight over the borders and unity of Israel as a national territory. And then also, it happens on, I would say, civilian battlefields. So the Israeli military constantly encounter civilians, not fighters. And you know, the concept of collateral damage, civilian victims, this idea is first introduced during the Lebanon period. So I think all this affects the way this occupation is remembered, the way it is circulated in Israeli society, the way, you know, it further fracture a sort of consensus around Israel military project. I want to say something about the protest, because for me it was, it is a very interesting aspect. Actually, my book starts with one of these protest movements, I would say the most successful anti-war, anti-military Jewish-Israeli movement, which is For Mothers. And I do want to say that I'm thinking more about the kind of like the popular discourse around the movement rather than the things that came out from the, you know, the movement and its initiators. For me, it's really interesting because once again, this is a feminist movement led by women. But the very interesting thing is that, you know, in order to articulate an anti-war, anti-occupation voice, the movement appropriates the voice of the mother. So, you know, if the civilian protest is the protest of mothers, then, you know, the subject that is being fought for is the son, right? What does it mean that, you know, soldiers all of a sudden become our sons? So the Four Mothers movement was established, I think it was 1997, after a massive accident between two helicopters in which 73 soldiers were killed. It is definitely the largest or the most fatal disaster during the Lebanon period. And it really shook.
For Israelis.
For Israelis. Yes, very important too. So it really shook, it shaked the Israeli society. Following that accident, which is, you know, also happened in a period in which for Israeli society, there are reports, daily reports on casualties in Lebanon. By the way, very little mentioning of, you know, the life taken by Israeli soldiers, including civilian life. The movement begins with four women, all of them mothers to soldiers who serve in the north of Israel and in Lebanon, who comes together and articulate a call to withdraw from Lebanon, saying, you know, we don't need to sit there anymore. For me, what is interesting is this kind of loop, right? So we can understand it as, you know, women performing or, you know, manifesting their gendered role in order to negotiate the system from within, right? So to actually use the position of motherhood in order to undermine the dominancy of patriarchy and militarism within Jewish Israeli society. But there is a flip to it, right? So what we get is also that soldiers become sons. And the other thing that kind of bugs me with this movement is that, you know, it is withdrawal for the sake of our children, for the sake of our morality, for the sake of our society. It's not a call on justice. It doesn't acknowledge the price that Israeli ongoing aggression and violence has on its neighboring countries, has on it, you know, on the people living across the border in Lebanon, in Palestine. So that's another thing that for me was really interesting, this kind of like, you know, the articulation of an anti-war leftist liberal voice that only looks inside, into the family, into the domestic sphere, basically.
Yeah, I want to get into that some more, but I think first I just want to talk a little bit about the continuation of the discourse that started during the Lebanon War. So you identified several major events in the history, in Israeli history over the last 25 years that as having had the cumulative effect of really increasing the very pervasive Israeli sense of victimhood. There were the suicide bombings in the mid-90s after the Oslo Accords were negotiated. And these suicide bombings, you know, really reached a peak during the Second Intifada, especially during the first few months of the Second Intifada, when there was at least one bombing per day, and they were very, very gruesome and dramatic. And then, of course, and you've written about this, there was the 2006 war with Hezbollah that had a very strong impact on Israel's perception of itself as being this, you know, we're minding our own business. And then suddenly we were attacked by people who have we're not in Lebanon anymore. Why would Hezbollah attack us? We're the victims here. So how do you remember those events? And talk a little bit, if you can, about how they affected you, how they affected your thinking and your emotions. And how do you think that those events, the suicide bombings and the 2006 war, how did they affect the evolution of Israel's national discourse?
So I can speak to it as someone who is, intimate with the Israeli experience as an Israeli, of course. And I would just say before I recount this experience to say that it is striking to me how when you step outside of it, you realize how much for an Israeli citizen, these are all happening in a vacuum. Like you have no idea there is this constant labor of decontextualizing that is happening when you live inside, inside these massive events. And in a way, it reminds me a little bit of the kind of conversation I'm having with Israelis today, for which the attacks of October 7th, happen outside of context. There is a, I constantly hear the phrase, we had misconceptions. We didn't, it is as if there was something that was fractured. Yeah. So, first of all, as I said, these events orient my own biography because I was living through these experiences and I was quite young when they happened. So I wasn't fully developed as a thinker or a critical thinker. One thing that strikes me is, when the suicide attacks are happening, they're happening on domestic ground. That is in the heart of Israeli cities that are considered to be a safe place. It is striking to think, the distance, not the physical distance, between Tel Aviv and Nablus, or Tel Aviv and Jenin, as if Nablus and Jenin can be completely unraveled by Israeli military power, and Tel Aviv is a safe space. And then when these attacks are happening, the response in the Israeli society is, first of all, one of shock, and then a sense of total victimization. This was unexpected. This came as a total surprise. Everyone involved is completely innocent. I don't want to legitimize hurting innocent people, and obviously civilians are innocent in the framework of war. But once again, I call it the Israeli amnesia, right? Or to detach itself from the region in which it lives and the violence that Israel itself is bringing to this region, and then the 2006 war was for me a formative moment for this project because. I think it's the first time that I experience war, so not a derailed occupation, but an actual war as an adult. And it was, to be honest, to be in this experience in Israel is quite shocking. You're constantly overwhelmed by the volume of the emotions, mostly. It's not just the news. It's this kind of like how the entire public sphere orients itself towards this. It becomes like a collective body that is orchestrating around this war effort. Both in terms of support. So, you know, I remember when I, you know, in later wars or operations in Gaza, when I went out to demonstrate, people were shocked that I'm demonstrating in time of war, because when war is happening, everyone needs to kind of like, you know, be this kind of like, you know, be the same front and just support the troops or support the war efforts. The other thing is this kind of like, you know, collective sentiment, first of all, of alertness. Everyone is drafted, so everyone might get bad news. And for me, it was interesting to reflect on this later on, because I realized that we have these protocols on how we're supposed to respond. Once, you know, someone we know, someone we love is, you know, died in war. We really have these strict protocols. Not only the military have protocols according to which it informs families or take care of families. I think that we, you know, families themselves have these unwritten protocols on how to respond, to process, to react to the death of their loved one as part of the war.
Yes, I was reporting the 2006 war. I was up at the northern border, and it was one of the most. It's one of the experiences of, you know, being under bombardment, and, you know, I literally was able to put my hand through a fence into Lebanon during the war, and I was listening to rockets all around me, and there were bomb shelter doors open, but I couldn't actually see anyone being killed. It's a very crazy experience. It's very noisy, but I remember coming down from the north back to Tel Aviv and looking around at everyone just living their lives, and it was only 2 hours drive away to the war, and then my phone rang, and this is a sign of how close-knit Israeli society is and how the collective is so important. A friend of mine who's very involved, she's quite high up in the literary world, in the publishing world, she says to me, "Lisa, it's terrible news. Grossman's son was killed." And she was talking about the very famous Israeli author, David Grossman, whose son Uri was called up for reserve duty in Lebanon during the war. And he was killed on the second to last or the last day of the war. I think after the ceasefire had already been agreed upon, but not gone into effect yet. And you mentioned that in your book as a, you know, as a very sort of iconic event that really reflects Israeli society. And you talk also, you write also about David Grossman's reaction to that event. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So when we talked before, I mentioned that for me, that was perhaps maybe one of the starting moments for this project. So I was in the aftermath of the 2006 war. I mean, first of all, I need to say that, you know, experiencing the war as an adult, I was really scared. So I think, you know, it shook me in a way. And in the aftermath of the war, I was about to go to New York to do an MA in film studies. And I remember sitting in a cafe on a Friday morning and reading a speech or a short essay that Grossman wrote about the loss of his son and how it affected his writing. And it was this essay was very interesting to me because he writes about how violence shaped the language that we speak. It shapes our very mode of expressions. It was very appealing to me. And it was interesting when I was writing the book, I went back to Grossman, I went back to this essay. I mean, I think that when I was reading it back then, I already knew that this is something that I want to think about. And then it found itself in this project. And interestingly, Grossman as perhaps today the most clear voice of Israeli liberal left became for me quite a target. One of the things that I ask myself is why does he constantly articulate, you know, the position of Israeli liberal left as a sort of a trap, as sort of like we don't have a choice. It, you know, I mean, your own language is framed by violence, but then we continue to speak it. What do we articulate when we repeat these words that we know that are violent? What do we give space to? So, I mean, Crossman became quite an interesting figure to me. At the time his son died, he was writing a book actually about a woman who sent her son to a large-scale military operation and knowing that he might not come back. And instead of him coming back, there might be three military officials at her door telling her that her son is dead. She just escaped her house. And I mean, the novel that Grossman ended up publishing after the death of his son articulates this fantastic, you know, unimaginable form of resistance. Just leave your home so the message won't meet you. For me, one of the things that the novel articulates is how the home becomes sort of, you know, an echo chamber for Israeli society, and in which, you know, violence resonates, but without a context, you know, in the sheer absence of once again. Was the sheer absence of Palestinian and Lebanese death. It's almost like a fate. It's something like, it's something that we're completely passive in relation to. So for me, Grossman's novel, The World That He Creates, was really a very powerful way to kind of like explain the way the family or the home become a form for this politics of disavowal that I try to articulate in this book.
Yes, that novel was translated into English with the title To the End of the Land, and it was received ecstatically by critics. It's a very, very beautiful novel, beautifully written and translated. But I absolutely take your point about this idea that we're, you know, the liberal Israeli discourse is such that you're simultaneously, you know, you oppose the occupation, you oppose the abuses of human rights that the army commits against Palestinians, you oppose the occupation of Lebanon, but in a way you're also quite complicit, because why are you opposing it? You're opposing it, as you say, because it's bad for Israeli society. But we don't actually individualize and humanize and talk about the way that the Palestinians who are feeling the impact of the occupation, who are feeling that violence. The liberal camp in Israel has been, you know, steadily shrinking since Benjamin Netanyahu was elected prime minister in 2009. And the Israeli population, it's very well documented, has shifted to the right and the far right. I think 52% of Israelis have steadily, for the last more than 5 years, identified as right wing. But there's still a substantial sector of the population who are like educated urban professionals. They hold liberal values, and they say they oppose the occupation. And again, like when they say why they oppose it, they describe their opposition in terms of how it undermines Israeli society, how it makes their country a worse place to live. They say it corrupts Israeli society, that it exacerbates gender divides, that it, of course, kills their children, that that the men who come back from serving in combat units in the occupied territories have a higher tendency toward committing acts of domestic violence, which is very interesting. That's part of the feminist discourse. But what's lost again is in this conversation is what the violence of the occupation is doing to the occupied people rather than just the occupiers. And so you tie this together in your book by talking about how these videos that we talked about in the beginning of our conversation, these videos that are made by families that show homemade clips of their fallen relatives, how they sort of enable a turning away from the impact of the occupation on Palestinians, how this, you know, mourning and over the dead soldiers through these videos allows people to sort of avoid that conversation about what the occupation is doing to the occupied instead of just to the occupiers.
I mean, it's interesting. First of all, you know, when we take military death and we situate it in the domestic sphere as something that happened to a loved one, not to a soldier, you know, so the soldier left the home and came back dead. What happened in between? It's completely absent. In the best case scenario, we'll have a detailed recollection of the circumstances under which the soldier died. But then there would be no account of, you know, war as an event that happens also to decide against which you fight, right? And the other thing is that, you know, in these videos, when military death is being encountered or you know, recollected, the army passes away as something that is very neutral and very naturalized in these, you know, civil spheres of domesticity and familiality. Things related to the military, like, you know, soldiers coming back over the weekends or, you know, after a few weeks, rejoining with their families, with their friends. It's almost like an everyday routine. We don't ask, or the viewers don't ask themselves, I mean, is this normal that the military is so omnipresent in all these aspects? So first of all, to say something about how naturalized this manifestation of violence is, you know, the presence of the military in Israeli everyday, Jewish Israeli everyday scenes. And then the other thing is, you know, Palestinian death, which is, it's completely absent in these videos. One of the things that I was struggling with quite a lot is how to speak about the absence of Palestinian death beyond the fact that it is absent. How to speak about this, I'm struggling a little bit to find the word. I mean, the volume of there is not a single moment in which someone is pausing and thinking about either Palestinian or Lebanese death. There is not a moment in which the horror and the suffering inflicted by Israel is encountered. And, you know, the videos always have an excuse that this is a personal memory, that this is the family memory. On this scale, that you know, war and violence are constantly being depoliticized, we need to ask ourselves questions. What are the politics of this disavowal, of this depoliticization?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a little bit of a lot of the consequences in the Israeli media's coverage, Israeli TV especially, their coverage of the current Gaza war. I've been watching quite a bit of it. I'm going to write about it. But what I'm seeing in the coverage is quite remarkable. So there were some international, some New York-based public radio stations that did media analysis of Israel, and they said, look, they're not showing Israelis anything about what's happening to civilians in Gaza. They'll show them some, you know, destroyed landscapes of crumbled houses, infrastructure that is identified as places where Hamas fighters were hiding, who they're always called, Hamas terrorists. But you don't see the tent camp in Rafah. You don't see the hospitals where people are lying on the floor in the emergency room. You don't see the rescue teams pulling civilians out of buildings that were hit by airstrikes. And also the advertising that I'm watching on Israeli TV, I think is something that would probably be of interest to you too. It's the advertising is very nationalistic. It's very gendered. It's very patriarchal. You'll see, you know, commercials that show a handsome bearded combat soldier with his gun slung over, you know, cross body. And he enters, you know, he's come back from a month or so on reserve duty, presumably in combat in Gaza, and he enters his typical Israeli apartment furnished with IKEA furniture, where his pretty wife and his three adorable children jump up and they greet him joyfully. And then it turns out that it's an advertisement for yogurt or for life insurance or for mortgage rates or something like that. It really feels that commercial television capitalism, for lack of a better word, is sort of, you know, simultaneously, you know, towing the line in terms of nationalistic and militaristic sentiment, but also exploiting this opportunity to make more money off nostalgia and emotion. And I think these are themes that you write about quite incisively in your book. And I'm wondering if you can speak about that a bit more.
To begin with, the history of Israel and Palestine, or, you know, the history of Palestine in Israel is a history of removal. Palestinians do not exist, as Golda Meir, the former Israeli prime minister, said in the past. Interesting for me is that since the withdrawal of Israel from Gaza and, you know, the erection of the separation wall in the West Bank, two processes that happened in early 2000, these two geographical and architectural projects also speaks to Israel, the kind of like the design of Israeli collective consciousness. Gaza do not exist. The West Bank do not exist. So there is no moment in which we encounter Palestinian death, Palestinian suffering. For me, what is more alarming, I mean, the level of death and suffering endured by Palestinian in Gaza right now is incredible, shocking, horrible. I'm also concerned by how much Israelis are unaware of the ongoing conditions in Gaza before October 7th. And this is one thing that I want to stress. I mean, what we see right now is undigestible amount of cruelty and violence, but it didn't come out of nowhere. The violence was there all the time. We need to think about the siege as an operation that allows this moment of once again, of looking away, of not being minded of what's happening in Gaza. Many of the Israelis with whom I spoke were convinced that Gaza was thriving before October 7th, as if there was no siege for, 17
years? 16 years, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one thing. I mean, so we have a removal of Palestinians. And on the other hand, we have this fixation on the home. I always say that the phenomena that I was studying ended somewhere during the Gilad Shalit affair. Gilad Shalit was a soldier who was taken or abducted or taken prisoner or taken hostage by Hamas in 2005. And after, I think he was in prison for 5 years and was eventually released. While he was in prison, his family led a massive campaign to his release, basically using the slogan, Gilad is our son. Once again, our sons. I would say that in the aftermath of the Shalit campaign, the term our son started to cater to very different sons. For instance, the soldier Elor Azaria, who was...
So Elor Azaria was, he was serving he was doing military duty in Hebron, which is one of the most stressed and most tense places in the West Bank. And this was just a few years ago. I think it was maybe 2017, 2018. I can't remember exactly. Now, there was a Palestinian man in Hebron who was just about the same age as Elor Azaria, who apparently ran toward a bunch of soldiers holding a 3-inch long knife. Someone shot him. He wasn't dead, but he was lying on the ground. And then somebody was videotaping the whole incident. A Palestinian from a window of their apartment videotaped the whole incident when Azaria walked up to this Palestinian man who was lying, as you say, disabled, not harming anyone, no longer holding a weapon, who had already been shot once, and they were waiting for an ambulance for him. And Azaria shot him at point blank range with his weapon. And he later was tried, and, you know, I think his trial really showed a change in Israeli attitude, whereas 10, 15, 20 years earlier, the whole country would have been revolted and by what Azaria had done. In this case, he became one of our sons who had been in danger, one of our collective sons who had been in danger, serving in the occupied territories, protecting Israelis, and he had done the right thing. And And that, yeah, speak some more about that.
Yeah. So first of all, I mean, it's important for me to mention the name of the person who was the victim of Azaria, and his name is Abd al Fattah al Sharif. So I think it's important to name his name. Interestingly, after the Azaria affair, the back then chief of staff, Gadi Eisenkot, was cited saying, Elaor Azaria is not our son. He is an adult man who is a soldier. So it was interesting for me that actually the military was, in a way, the voice of reason in this wannabe familial drama of Elaor Azaria. So for me, it's really interesting how the family became a form or a brand name in Israeli society. And same goes for militarism. There is something parallel in these two brands in a way. You know, the Israeli intellectual Noam Yoran constantly say how with the privatization of television, the nation itself becomes a brand name. It's interesting how when you look into these advertisements, into these the way they reproduce this bourgeois setting of the family. Once again, I mean, the military is a sphere of familiarity, not of violence. It is a place where family feelings, family togetherness, the family home is reaffirmed, rather than a place where a place where state politics is being performed. For me, it's quite puzzling what's happened when the violence is brought home and domesticated. And this is not to say that it is domestic violence. It's actually to say that the violence is completely neutralized. It's a matter in which we Jewish Israelis rely to each other, reaffirm our identity without taking into consideration the fact that the presence of the military is not a form of defense. It is and has been for a very long time a form of aggression endured by Palestinian subjects.
Yeah, I think a lot about that when I see on my Facebook wall my Israeli friends who have adult, children who have turned 18. And, most of my friends in Israel, at the very least, they're liberal, if not actually left wing. But, with the exception of the small minority on the left wing fringe that identify as anti-Zionist and whose children refuse to serve, they're a very small minority. Most of my friends post these pictures of taking their children to the conscription office on the day that, every Israeli high school kid, Jewish Israeli high school kid, gets a conscription notice when they're 18 years old and the date when they're going to go into the army. The whole family is like, it's the equivalent of what they do in the States when the ritual of taking the kids off to college when they leave home. But instead of taking them to college, they take them, they pack a picnic in the backseat of the car and drive the kids to go get conscripted to the army. And they take photographs hugging their children goodbye and all posing, facing the camera with their arms wrapped around one another. And, I have an Israeli friend here who said, it's like everyone's living in a psychotic trance or something. Like you're taking your kids to go into the army to be trained to kill people. What are you celebrating here? And yet this has been a ritual for 18-year-old kids for many, many years in Israel. Which sort of brings me to my final question, which is a little bit of a personal question. And especially since October 7th, I know personally, I don't talk about it, with my friends in Israel. I have a very, very small group of friends. I know what their views are. And I'll talk about Gaza and October 7th with them. But with most of my friends, I stay silent. For many reasons, you don't want to reawaken the trauma. You don't know what their views are. You don't want to get into a fight. But while your political views might diverge from your childhood friends and your families, I'm sure that you are powerfully affected by their trauma and by what happened on October 7th and what's happening now in Gaza. So can you talk to me a little bit about that, the evolution in your views and how that's affected your relationships and your personal relationships and how it's going today since October 7th?
So first of all, I'm trying to think about October 7th as something that is not a rupture or not, once again, a bracketed event. I'm trying to think how some undercurrents are continuous before that. And I had difficult conversations with my family, with some friends about, you know, my own political and critical views before. A good friend of mine who studies genocide told me in the aftermath of October 7th that she finds herself adjusting her tone according to who she's talking to. And she made the very interesting observation. She said, but this is what conflict does. It divides. It is as if there are two narratives that cannot be put in the same sentence. I need to admit that I sometimes find myself adjusting my tone, and it is indeed very, very isolating. But on the other hand, you know, facing what we see right now in Gaza, I cannot keep quiet. I am very strategic about the way that I speak and also about the way that I listen, but you know, I don't censor myself. I am a bit more nuanced about the way I approach people. I practice more listening than speaking, but also understanding that, you know, listening itself would help me later speak. I think that, you know, many of us, not just critical Israelis, but also critical Palestinians, I think in general, people who are engaged or care about what happened find ourselves isolated, find ourselves feeling divided in a way, which for me make me ask questions about the way this conflict persists in a sort of a zero-sum equation, in which you cannot, you know, you cannot create a sentence that would remain the same when you speak to Jewish Israelis or to Palestinians. And this is something that I personally have been invested in and trying to work through, at least around myself, to create a community or a sort of collectivity in which, people can share their mourning. People can listen to each other. Palestinians and Jewish Israelis, can come together and articulate a call for, obviously, for immediate ceasefire, for the end of the siege, the end of the occupation, for Palestinian liberation, for a better future, for both people on the same land. You know, in the past month after October 7th, I found myself listening to stuff that were very painful for me to hear, stuff that hurt me as a human being, that were too difficult to contain, that were perhaps a form of disappointment, that I absolutely disagreed with. And at a certain point, I realized that I need to be in this uneasy position of listening. No matter how hard it is to contain some of the things. I need to listen because I need to understand how these things work, because I think that only through listening I can maybe try and formulate anything that is future looking. I don't think that I'm trying to articulate your hyper optimistic theory around listening, but I felt that, I mean, the violence is so enormous that actually we need to sit with it and we need to fully articulate it so it would resonate. If we listen and listen and listen, perhaps at the end someone would listen back. But I really felt that there is a need to extend our listening and allow people to articulate their opinions, obscene as they are, in order to engage in conversation and perhaps try to unpack or disarm some of them. And then I do believe that there is a very active force in listening. this is not to say that I accept any opinion. God, no. But I did find myself engaged with opinions that made me feel uncomfortable, but understanding that I need to contain these positions and I need to speak to it as well. What's happening right now, first of all, is an attack on people, but also it's an attack on the act of politics itself or the space for politics. So for me, we need to insist on this space in which politics can formulate, in which people can educate each other and talk to one another. And it's not an easy conversation. It's a horrible one. But there is something there that we need to insist on. I mean, what I witnessed since October 7th is, and I mentioned it before, it's not just a kind of like ideological crisis or political crisis in Israel. I think that the global left is in a huge crisis. And this has manifested itself since October 7th.
Laliv Melamed, thank you very much for joining us on The Lead. This has been The Lead, a podcast from New Lines magazine. This week's episode was produced by Finbar Anderson and hosted by me, Lisa Goldman. For more episodes like this, subscribe to The Lead on your favorite podcast app or visit our website, newlinesmag.com. Thank you all for joining us.